road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends.
Road trips, station wagons, Stuckies, Howard Johnson's, Route 66, wall drugs, rest areas. Remember all those things? Do those words bring back memories of the road trip? I have such great memories of growing up with my parents and my brothers and sisters going on road trips, whether it was when I was a kid or the disorganized ones in college where we decided to go at the last minute, or some of the more recent ones that I've done as a professional road tripper. If you like road trips and you've ever been on one or want to go on another one, you must read Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip by Richard Ratté, who is joining us on WGN right now. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Good, Karen. Thank you for having me on.
Great. You know, I wanted you to road trip to Chicago to be here, but I guess you couldn't do that.
No, that would have been a good excuse to get down there. It's been a while since I've been to Chicago. That would have been a fun trip.
But that's okay. That's all right. We can talk on the phone. Let's talk about what I like about your book, Richard, and I did read it, is you take all the facts and the history of the speed limits on Fuzzbusters, on the history of driving and gasoline and all those things, and you weave them into your personal experiences as a kid driving with your parents and your dad's little quirks, and making it interesting with anecdotes but also being educational. So I really, really enjoyed it. Let me start by asking, why were road trips more common back in the 50s and 60s than they are now?
Well, the golden era of road trips, or what I call the golden era, in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, they really have their roots going back to World War II. Of course, it was the draft and enlistment that whisked young men off of their farms and out of their urban neighborhoods and sent them off to train in different areas of the country, you know, places like California and Texas and Florida. And for many of these young men, it was really their first time, you know, seeing life beyond their familiar surroundings. So it was their, you know, first time getting exposed to different areas of the country, and many found that they really liked it. So after the war, they'd kind of been bitten by that travel bug. They wanted to return to some of these places like Florida, and they wanted to explore this great country. And of course, they were having kids in vast numbers at that time. It was the era of the baby boom, of course. And it was also a time of tremendous economic prosperity. So these men had lots of disposable time and money, and they had these new families where they wanted to get out and explore America. And that's what led to the travel boom, the road travel boom.
And you talk about something a little interesting that I didn't know about, but there weren't a lot of motels and places to go there. So people would just pull over and they'd like pop up a little tent, and people would just kind of do trespassing camping, sort of. I mean,
yeah,
which I never knew about. That was an interesting phenomenon.
It was a phenomenon called auto camping, and it really became popular in the 1920s and 30s, which was the first kind of road travel boom as people were starting to finally be able to afford cars and, of course, go out and explore America in those cars. So you're right. They would just, when night fell, they would just pull off at the side of the road wherever they found a nice clearing or a farmer's field, and they would just set up camp. And some of the people who owned property along the roadways got kind of tired of this. They got tired of people, you know, squatting on their property at night and squatting in their property in the morning. That was when metropolitan areas began to set up their own tourist camps, they called them, and gradually these evolved into motor courts and then motels.
You know, you talk about how the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit slowed everything down, but I think one of my favorite parts of your book is when you talk about how your dad liked to speed and how he would engage the children in helping him violate the law, and also his issue with the empty gauge signs. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, of course, you know, we did have devices to deal with the new lower speed limit back then, you know, devices like the Fuzzbuster, but my dad wasn't like that. You know, he wanted to be seen as a fine, upstanding member of the community, so he didn't want to be seen as one of these people who'd put a Fuzzbuster up on their dashboard, you know, because that branded you as kind of a lawbreaker. So he involved all of us as kids. He would assign each one of us a zone of the highway, either in front of us or behind us, to be on the lookout for law enforcement, you know, highway patrol officers with their radar guns out. And he would, maybe take care of the left-hand side of the road himself. He'd assign one of us the right-hand side. Another one of us would be looking out the rear view in case anybody was trying to sneak up on us from behind.
Well, Richard,
and he'd even have one of us looking overhead to see if there was any aircraft that was keeping track of our speed as well. So it became a family affair.
You're making this sound like a sweet little memory, but really we call this aiding and abetting. Just so you know.
Spoken like an attorney.
That's right. That's right. I want to talk. I want to open up the phone lines. If anyone has an interesting road trip that they took, I don't want a real long story about it, but what were interesting road trips that you've taken that you would do again or that you really enjoyed? Give us a call here at 312-981-7200. We're talking to Richard Ratté, author of Don't Make Me Pull Over, a book about road tripping. One of the interesting stories you tell has a connection to WGN Radio, and that's on the issue of Fuzzbuster, right?
The radar gun.
It's a radar gun. That's
was
right.
Developed in the Chicago area by a research scientist by the name of Bryce K. Brown. He'd actually been involved with the Manhattan Project, and he's the one that came up with the technology for a practical application of radar to be used by police to determine the speed of motorists. But the very first officer to actually stop somebody because of the readout of a radar device was a gentleman by the name of Leonard K. Baldy. He was, a young patrol officer, and so he kind of he was the one who got the first motorist for going too fast. He gradually atoned for that sin, though. He was eventually hired by WGN Radio to be there in the air helicopter traffic reporter. Unfortunately, he has kind of a sad end to his story because the helicopter that he was monitoring traffic in one day crashed into a railroad yard. And unfortunately, he lost his life in the performance of those duties. But that's the tie-in to WGN.
Interesting. And he has an honorary street at Bradley Place, I think Tallman Avenue, which is very, very interesting. Give us a call here if you have an interesting road trip that you'd like to share with us, 981-7200. And when we come back, we're going to talk about CB radio, the motels, and the food along the way for road trips. You're listening to Karen Conti's show on WGN. Talking to Richard Ratté, who wrote Don't Make Me Pull Over, all about road trips, the history of the road trip. And I want to talk a little bit about the advent of the CB radio. At one point, you say in your book, Richard, that there were 14 million people who were registered CB users. That's astounding.
Isn't it, though? And among them were First Lady Betty Ford and Mel Blanc, of course, who was the famous voice behind Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, many of the voices for the Warner Brothers cartoon characters, and he would often get on his CB radio out in the LA area and appear in character or talk on the CB radio in character, amusing other listeners, especially when he came across kids who were also on CB radios.
Unbelievable. Okay, now we're going to do a little remember these little, what are they, handles or jargon or whatever they're called. I'm going to say the name of the CB jargon, and you're going to tell me what it is, all right?
That's a big 10-4, good buddy.
Chicken choker.
A chicken choker was a slow-moving poultry truck, the kind you didn't want to get behind on the interstate.
A pregnant roller skate.
That would be a VW Beetle.
My favorite is Kojaks with Kodaks.
Yes, that would be a highway patrolman with his radar gun out. That was also more colorfully known as a hemorrhoid with a Polaroid.
And Blinkin' Winkin'.
That would be a school bus, another vehicle you didn't really want to get behind on the roadways.
And finally, the anchor clanker.
That would be a car pulling a boat.
Ah, There you go. See, we gave you a little refresher course in case you want to get on your CB radio. I'm going to just mention a few funny texts here. 708 says, fond memories of road trips and bumper stickers. Remember? Merrimack Caverns, the Ozarks in Missouri. Lots of ma-and-pa hotels where the owners lived on the premises. I do remember that. And they put the bumper stickers on your car no matter if you wanted to or not, right? So you still...
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So for years, we'd have this peeling Mammoth Caves or whatever it was. We have another texter from the 269 area code that said, in the 50s, my relatives took a road trip to Florida. The kids slept in the bed of the truck. Parents stopped to get coffee. One of the kids snuck out to use the bathroom, and it figured out that the kid left 3 hours later.
Oh no.
Sounds like...
And that wasn't uncommon for people to travel in the back of flatbeds of, you know, pickup trucks if they were covered. Or in my case, you know, I would often ride around up on the rear window shelf of my dad's big old 1970s land yacht. Or, of course, many of us have nauseous memories of those rear-facing seats in the back of the Ford Country Squire station wagon, right?
Yeah, we had one with... Yes, we had wood paneling. We were an elite family. We had the wood paneling.
Nice.
I know.
And
you're
impressed. Do you know why station wagons had that wood paneling?
No, Karen? I don't. Please tell me.
It actually goes back to the origins of the station wagon, and it's hinted at in the name. Station wagons were wagons that were used around stations in the early 1900s, and those stations were train stations because in the early 1900s, of course, trains were the predominant form of long-distance transportation, but what was still needed was a vehicle to get passengers from their homes with their big old travel trunks to the train stations. And so handymen would take the Model Ts, which weren't really made for that purpose. They would hack off the metal bodies at the windshield, recreate that rear body entirely in wood so it would accommodate passengers up front and their big travel trunks in the rear, and that's what gradually evolved into the station wagons we know today. And so when car manufacturers of the 1970s would slap that fake wood paneling on the sides, it was kind of an homage to the original station wagons of the early 1900s.
Did anybody in our listening audience know that? I don't think so. Let's go to Joe. He's been holding. He wants to tell us about his road trips. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Good.
Karen, you know, first of all, I think my father has a copyright on it. Don't make me pull over. Somewhere along the line. That and my mother telling us, don't make me get your father. I'm from a family, five brothers and one sister. And every year growing up, my father would take a month off of work. That's how their vacations went back then. He had so much time in with the company. He had 30 days off. And we would go up to Wisconsin, and all of us in a Chevy Bel Air, sleeping up on the back of the window, laying across the hump in the floor.
Oh, yes.
No seatbelts.
How about air conditioning?
Nothing. It was, you know, gosh.
Those are all very, very sweet memories. Thank you for sharing. Now, let's talk a little bit about the motels. I mean, I think of ice buckets. Who is going to take that plastic ice bucket and run to that ice machine, right? Why? We just wanted ice. Roll-away cots, those little rusty roll-away, fold them up. We had the Gideon's Bible, of course, always in there. And remember that paper banner, what do you call it, on the toilet seat? Toilet seat? So you knew it was clean. And always, of course, those little fold-out suitcase holders. Tell me about motels. My favorite was Howard Johnson's. It has an interesting history, Richard. Can you tell us about it? Oh, hold on. Richard?
More famous as one of the great restaurant chains first, right?
Yeah,
they didn't
add
lodging until the late 1970s. And really, Howard Johnson's had its roots in the 1920s. He was a young entrepreneur who bought a pharmacy with a soda counter near Boston in the 1920s. And, of course, that was a very competitive business. Everybody was trying to get customers to their soda counters. And so what Howard Johnson figured is he needed to offer better ice cream. So he bought the recipe of a local vendor who was retiring, discovered that his secret, this guy's recipe, was so popular because it actually tripled the amount of butter fat that even that wasn't good enough for Johnson. He went down in his basement with his own hand-crank maker and came up with 28 different flavors of ice cream. Everything from fruit salad and frozen pudding to orange pineapple. And he started offering this at his soda counter. It became extremely popular. And he added food, the famous clam strips, which, of course, Howard Johnson was also known for. You remember those?
The fried
clam strips.
That was exotic for me.
But what really set Johnson apart was he invented franchising. He licensed his recipes and his name to other restaurant operators. And he also saw the promise of, you know, these interstate, the turnpikes that were being built at that time. He bought exclusive contracts to have his restaurant on these travel plazas. And, you know, families started looking forward to going to a Howard Johnson's for a nice ice cream treat after a great dinner at Howard Johnson's. And Howard Johnson's, after they added lodging in the 1970s, became the largest hospitality chain in the world for a while.
And, you know, it's interesting because we all love those mom-and-pop motels, and you can remember, like, one of our listeners said, the owners might be living on the premises, and they'd have that little diner with maybe, like, 8 tables where you'd eat your breakfast in the morning, and the little tiny postage stamp swimming pool smelled like chlorine, and it was all nice, but I remember my parents saying, but at least we know it's Howard Johnson's. We know we're going to get the same thing every single time. And when you're traveling with kids, sometimes that's a good thing.
Yeah, that was the secret of the great chains, not just the restaurants, but also the motel operators like Holiday Inn and Ramada Inn. They offered travelers predictability and consistency, right? A Big Mac in Milwaukee tasted the same as one in Memphis.
Right.
It was also a taste of the familiar while families were traveling in very unfamiliar places. So it was, you know, it was a form of comfort to them, and they weren't going to be surprised. They knew what to expect. And of course, anyone who's ever traveled with kids is, you know, you don't want surprises, right?
Right, especially when there's no air conditioning. And I just remember my legs, like, sticking to everything, right? Ray from Northbrook, quickly tell me what your favorite road trip is.
It's a takeoff on the title of your book. Senior pastor was doing a sermon on sayings that you learned growing up. And Joe Fabioli, maybe you guys know him, was wheelchair-bound. And Joe brings the microphone up to him, and he goes, "Don't make me pull this car over." And the whole place broke out laughing.
That's funny. That's funny. Thank you for that insight. Let us Richard, I think Richard's on his own road trip here. Richard, I want to ask you, I'll tell you my favorite road trip. Well, I've got a couple favorite road trips. One was, of course, Route 66. The most pleasant surprises, Tulsa, Oklahoma is beautiful. The Oklahoma City bombing memorial was unbelievably uplifting. Winslow, Arizona was a little disappointing, but I did like the Eagles tribute, the little statue that they have there. And Jerry and I last year drove from Chicago to New Orleans, which was a great road trip. We went through to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis and went through Mississippi and went to Old Miss and on down to the Big Easy. That was a great one. Tell me about your favorite road trips.
Well, I know everyone always expects me to recall one from the 1970s when I was out traveling, you know, with my own siblings and parents. But I got to tell you, one of my recent road trips with my wife and kids just a few years ago was really my favorite. And it was that classic American road trip out to Mount Rushmore.
And it wasn't
the final destination. You know, I loved Mount Rushmore. That was great to see and everything. But it was the stops along the way that really made the trip. We stopped at places like the Field of Dreams in Dyersville, Iowa, where they filmed a famous movie. And then later on, we stopped at the Surf Ballroom, which is the last venue that Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Richie Valens played at before they boarded on, you know, that airplane and crashed in a nearby cornfield. And the Surf Ballroom is still kind of a museum to them and to music of that era. And we went to places like the Minuteman Missile Museum along I-90 in South Dakota. Of course, during the Cold War, you know, the bulk of America's nuclear arsenal was stored out in South Dakota. You can still see decommissioned Minuteman missiles in their silos, just as they were during the 1970s and 80s, you know, when we were under the threat of constant nuclear attack.
And what's that town where all the motorcycles go? That's kind of on that route, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it is. And we went there. What is Sturgis. The name of it.
Yep. Thank you. Yep. Yeah, that is a great road trip. I ended up at Mount Rushmore for 4th of July with the light shows going on. But you're right. It was the stuff along the way that was probably more interesting than actually seeing Mount Rushmore. I just want to talk generally about it. You say there was a line from your book. You say, just as video killed the radio star, cheap travel would soon snuff out the family road trip. Why do you think that's the case?
Yeah, it was deregulation of the airlines in 1978 under the Carter administration. That was really the beginning of the end of the golden era of road trips. It was because the reason that everybody was traveling by car during the 50s and 60s and 70s was because airfares were so expensive. They were 3 to 8 times what we would pay today. Following deregulation, that was when airfares plummeted and people realized they could get to their destinations without all the, you know, supposed hassle of road travel and, of course, get there much, much more quickly. So they began parking their cars and boarding airplanes, and that was kind of the end of road trips for a while.
Well, and I do remember, like, when I was a kid, only rich people could fly on airplanes. It wasn't something that we all could do. Richard, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I am going to give out my copy of Richard Ratay's Don't Make Me Pull Over to the third caller. Ben, the third caller is going to get this great book. I recommend it to everyone. Richard, where can everyone get this book?
Oh, they can find it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or, of course, it's always good to support our local independent booksellers as well.
We like that. Richard, thank you so much for joining us, author of Don't Make Me Pull Over. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. I had fun.
All right.